Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Such a nice atmosphere in here tonight. I feel like everyone knows each other, which seems like it's probably true. I'd like to welcome everyone to Third Place Books and say thanks for being here. Tonight, we are really proud to welcome Merrill Club, veteran, author, and professor emeritus of English at the University of Montana. He's here this evening to speak to us about his new book, A Life Disturbed, My Pacific War Revisited. Told through letters that he himself sent from the Pacific Theater of World War II, A Life Disturbed explores a life forever changed by war. Please join me tonight in welcoming Merrill Club. Thank you.
A Life Disturbed, My Pacific War Revisited. Is a kind of then and thou, then and now, not thou, but then and now, memoir of World War II. And I revisited the war through the eyes of the young man who wrote a bunch of letters, quite a long series of letters, to my parents during the war. And I have revisited the war. I'm revisiting the war again in the process of writing this book through the mind of an old man, trying to think about what that war was all about. At least to me. So what I'm doing is trying to now to explain what I think about the war in general, and to say how it may or may not have affected my life. By way of background, I was trained in midshipman school for Navy ship duty and not land warfare. But after a short term of duty as a shore patrol officer in San Francisco, I was assigned as a naval gunfire liaison officer to Army or Marines for amphibious landings on various islands in the Pacific. And I think that this is probably the only, as far as I know, published description of naval gunfire liaison teams that I know of. The first battle that I attended was the Battle of Kiska, which was a kind of a fiasco, to say the least, because 35,000 American soldiers and American and Canadian soldiers landed with some 300 ships in support on Kiska, expecting 10,000 fanatical Japanese. An earlier operation had been Attu, which the Japanese had fought to the last man, virtually. Almost no one was taken prisoner. And so we were expecting quite a lot. It turned out that the Japanese had been withdrawn some 3 weeks before the landing, so that here we had this huge armada of naval ships and all of the army, and both American and Canadian, going ashore. And right at first, they started shooting at each other. And we did. It's a joke in a way, and we thought so at the time. But we didn't think so at the time, because of a cemetery had been set up, and they were burying people in the cemetery as a result of those platoons and companies running into each other in the fog. But at any rate, the problem for me in a reading of this sort is that I can understand readings of poetry, because poetry has a long, long oral tradition, and even now it's written to be recited. But for me, at any rate, prose at first glance is something that I'm not sure one should get involved in reading. But then again, I have to think that prose also has a long oral tradition, and so that I feel a little bit better doing it. But also, I have a little problem in reading the letters that I wrote home, because I don't much like reading from letters that I wrote to dear Mom and Daddy, Mom, some 60 years ago. But at any rate, I'll begin by reading from one of those letters anyhow, and from the, well, I'm beginning in the middle of one of them. Excuse my voice, I just lost it, I guess, today. That night we went into a, this is on Macon Island. Well, that's not Macon Island, it's Macon Atoll, which is a sort of circular group of islands around a lagoon. And then, and some of the islands are large enough to be inhabited, so most of them are not. At any rate, the third night, we went into a perimeter defense to, in effect, more than a more or less a circle with a diameter stretching from one side of the island to the other, and dug in for the night. For the first time, I experienced real terror. About 8 o'clock p.m., we heard a bunch of natives, men, women, and children, talking and coming up the road. A baby was crying, and they were let through the front lines and made to stay in the middle of the CP. About 10 minutes later, two Japanese walking up the road, talking loudly to each other. Of course, they were shot, and that was the end of, that was the signal for the most terrific clatter of machine gun and grenades and automatic rifles I've ever heard or imagined. During an occasional interlude, I could hear the Japs shouting, "Guard, guard, I'm coming through," or "Joe, it's me, I'm wounded, come and get me." In the midst of it all, the baby would cry, a rooster crow, a hitman scream. It was an eerie night. They kept up for 10 hours until dawn, or that did. Bullets flew a few inches above my hole, occasionally knocking dirt into it, and I only prayed that tomorrow night I might have a chance to dig a deeper one. After I got used to the firing, I was lulled by the machine gun fire and was able to sleep very fitfully. The Japs were sackied up, as was shown from their canteens the next morning, and some of them broke through. One was within about 10 feet of me, one of my men told me, before he was scared off, and I'm glad I didn't know it. The long-awaited and prayed-for dawn, to use a cliche, I didn't, finally arrived with soldiers carrying in wounded buddies and orders for stretcher bearers to get forward and to get the more seriously wounded. There were about 200 in the attack, and 100 were counted dead. We lost a few. The night grayed into day and started raining upon one horrible scene. Men walking around dazed with the staring eyes, some laughing at high-pitched voices, some sitting staring dumbly or crying out, and of course the usual killer talking of his exploits of shooting and stabbing a man 6 times before he died. One captain, a pretty close friend of mine, had been in the brunt of the attack. I learned later that he had stabbed one of his own men, thinking that he was fighting a Japanese. When I saw him, that he had already going to pot with that knowledge on his soul. There were dead and mutilated everywhere, some lying half in foxholes where they had been shot in their charge, others with something white where an elbow had been, others staring up at you mutely, questioning, their arms raised as though they were to ward off a blow. They were pale, yellowish-blue color, and the rain pattered down silently. A fly would crawl slowly across the face of one of the dead, and the dead made no effort to brush it away when it must have tickled his nose. It seems strange, and it does now, that the sight of all that death and destruction didn't affect me more. Maybe I was too numbed, or maybe I had to condition myself beforehand. I had wondered before how the sight of a man in a human human being without a head would affect me. I could stare down at them, looking very much like, I suppose, like the conqueror in a picture you've probably seen, disinterestedly. our own men dead the same way. I can't tell you of all the details of men stabbing with a bayonet, wounded men because they made too much noise, or of tanks squashing bodies into the roads, or of prisoners being stabbed and shot, or the ears being cut off for the souvenirs. I want to read just a commentary. I want to read one more passage from that. No, I want to read the commentary. When I think back upon the Banzai charge that continued all the third night on Macon, I remember confusion of feelings and thought as I lay with my head at the apex of the wide V-shaped foxhole I had dug with my corporal. The sound of intense rifle fire and machine gun fire not far away at the outer edge of the perimeter, hand-to-hand fighting going on nearby. Trembling and afraid, I remember thinking it wasn't my war, it wasn't my job as a naval officer to get out of my hold and shoot. It was the job of the soldiers around me. My carbine useless for the defense of a foxhole, I lay there in my back trying to sink deeper and deeper into the sand with the knife I had bought in San Francisco held close to my chest, the blade pointed upwards toward the sky, to save me from any Japanese soldier who might have the temerity to jump in on top of me with his sword or bayonet. Joe, my corporal, whispered every few minutes, "Club, club, are you all right? Are you still alive?" I suppose I would have tried to kill if I'd been forced to, but I still don't know. And the feeling that it wasn't my job to be killing people, or perhaps the fear of killing, followed me throughout the war. Part of what I was feeling turned out not to have been particularly unique to me, I learned later. After the Iwo Jima campaign in 1945, I received a large batch of material from the Josiah Macy Foundation, which included several articles by an Army colonel, S.L.A. Marshall, Slam Marshall as he was known. Although I did not know it at the time, Marshall had been with my battalion the night of the Banzai charge on Macon, or most likely arrived very early the next morning, and he had written a number of articles describing his experiences, and one of the descriptions that he gave was of the Macon attack, or the attack upon this group, and he reviewed it quite accurately, seemed to me. And he had been interested since World War I, actually, in what he called problems of command in minor tactics and the ratio of fire ratios under combat conditions. He had interviewed frontline soldiers, or he'd worked out a process for interviewing frontline soldiers all over all throughout the European campaign and throughout the Pacific. And what he found was, after interviewing some 400 companies, the men who were supposed to fight, it was their job to shoot their rifles, he discovered that only 15% normally, no more than 25%, ever fired their rifles. When they had opportunities to do so, they could see Japanese out there, but they just refused to fire. And so that obviously poses a very real problem for training soldiers. And as I understand it, things began to improve as far as the Army was concerned by Vietnam, when it's something like 85% of the soldiers actually fired their weapons. And then I'm sure by Iraq they must be pretty close to 95% from all I can hear. But what his final conclusion was that people were simply as afraid of killing other people as they were afraid of dying. And none of these soldiers who refused to fire were malingerers, he pointed out. They were risking their lives and they died, but they simply couldn't kill other people. And it's, this is interesting in a way from the point of view of people in Seattle. I'm not native to Seattle, but it's interesting because, as I understand it, John Marshall, the grandson of Slam Marshall, is an investigative reporter for the Post-Intelligencer paper. And he wrote a very interesting book several years ago in which he described his grandfather. And but I won't go into that because it's quite a long discourse. Anyhow, I'd like to move on to another part, another letter, which is was written describing the situation off of Guam just before the landing on Guam. And that we were aboard an LST off Guam in July 20, 1944. Tomorrow is the day, I wrote to my parents. There are so many things I want to say, and I can't think of a thing. This one, I fear, will be full-sized, and I should have plenty of time for thoughts amidst the bursting of shells. I think that's what follows. Bursting of shells. In my pack are a book of poetry of a Galsworthy novel, one of Jane Austen's, and Conrad's Lord Jim. I see the news in the news that Arne Anderson ran the mile in 4.1.6. That's really going. The show is within sight now, the flashes of gunfire over the horizon. I asked a man today what he was fighting for. He didn't know, being a professional soldier. Then I asked him why he hates the Japs. Because they're a different color. Speak a different language because they can't understand. I can't understand them. Well, he's honest anyway. I am about to give up all this and come home. The usual small signs of nervousness in anticipation before battle are becoming evident in everyone. The night before is of particular interest to me. One person reads, one person sleeps, another worries about the heat, another walks around drinking coffee, some talk, pick up this, drop that, and my mind wanders so much I can hardly write words, much less anything sensible. My usual reaction is to get sleepy and then not be able to sleep, but here's to try anyway. Moving on to in the middle of the Battle of Guam, I'd like to read one section. After a few days of being pinned down, the CP was able to move up forward. As we walked along the littered road, we came under artillery fire and we all dived into the ditches beside the road, each of us struggling to get under someone else and have the shelter of somebody else's body. It is sickening what one will do out of fear and to stay alive. From there, we moved forward to the end of the peninsula with no resistance except snipers. Beside one blockhouse, I came upon 11 dead Japanese, one without a head, another with his guts spilled out in his hands, another with a foot and arm blown off, another with an empty skull, another with no marks, except a small hole just over his ear. All of their clothes had been blown off. As I stood looking at that heap of clay, the thought came to me that I should be sick at my stomach. But I pushed it out of my mind and started imprinting the picture indelibly in my mind. Then the thought came to me, am I responsible for this carnage? I had been spotting fire from the cruiser onto these very blockhouses. I walked further past the bodies and looked down upon a leg with leggings and two-toed shoe lying there in the middle of the trail, nothing else. That is what a strange sight. It had been blown off just above the knee and the owner was nowhere around. I wrote many letters from Iwo Jima because I mean, my practice normally was to write a letter which summarized any one group of letters that had to do with a particular battle, and I would write a summary letter of the of Kiska, a summary letter of Macon, a summary letter of Guam. But when it came to Iwo Jima, I guess I got tired and I just wrote a series of letters throughout the operation, many of them from foxholes, so to speak. And so I'll only read one, which I wrote just before the landing on Iwo Jima, and then I'll read one right after the Iwo Jima, when I was answering questions to my father when I wrote home. This is a troop ship off Iwo Jima, February 19, 1945. Here it is again, as you will have guessed by now, by the time this reaches you. The last three letters of this sort have completely drained me, and I have practically nothing to say. We land on Iwo Jima probably the day after tomorrow. This time I have no feeling at all. I know what to expect and have only intense fear, disgust, and hate for the next few days. Never in my life have I hated so much the thought of something I knew that I would have to do. It is an entirely new emotion, although the beginnings of it were apparent in the last operation. The only bright spot, if it may be termed bright, is that the tremendous slaughter will take place only in a few days, stretched out to 26 or 30 days, actually. Also, since I am a regimental gunfire officer, this time I should be well back behind the front lines instead of virtually in them, as was often the case when I was attached to a battalion. And reading from a later letter, I'm taking it from the middle. I had the doubtful pleasure of recommending for a Silver Star one of my spotters who was killed. So his wife gets two little pieces of metal plus a dog tag in return for her husband. His mother doesn't get anything for her son. There were 15 casualties in my team, and including four dead. I have a fine tent mate in a typical rising young businessman. He is the kind of a boy any mother would be delighted to have as a son-in-law, a steady churchgoer, a naval officer, a fraternity man, owner of his own dry cleaning establishment in civilian life. He has a fine collection of Jap teeth, personally acquired by vying with the maggots swarming in and out of rotting Jap heads. The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. He is a nice man, though. I heard from Jack yesterday. He has a guard company in San Diego. Thanks for the clipping, Mama. No, I didn't run into anybody from Stillwater on Iwo Jima. And then finally, one section, which is a comment upon the whole business at that point, which has to do what I think of as the relativity of war. Again, I am reminded of what I think of as the relativity of war. For me, Kiska, with no Japanese defenders, had been a real battle. Macon, as significant as Tarawa. And Guam, I guess nobody recognizes the word Tarawa anymore, but Tarawa was about 100 miles either north or south, I can't remember which, from Macon. And at that point, it was the bloodiest battle that the Marines had engaged in up to that time. At any rate, Macon, as significant as Tarawa, and Guam, it was hell. When I look back on Iwo Jima, I know it was not the 5th Corps that won the presidential citation, although the upper echelons in the Corps served their important functions. It was primarily the officers and men at the company and platoon levels, the men in direct contact with the enemy, who really won the presidential citation. Now, at various times, I was under sometimes constant artillery and mortar barrages, as well as machine gun and rifle fire. I underwent banzai and counterattacks. I was virtually blown up on Iwo Jima. But my war experiences cannot compare with that of the individual frontline platoon or squad leader and rifleman, blowing up bunkers, flame-throwing pillboxes, killing in close proximity, often in hand-to-hand fighting. Killing at a distance, as when calling down fire from a destroyer or a cruiser, or on a pillbox, or a concentration of men, is not killing up close, where you see and even feel the men you kill. I was lucky. I remember the captain of the cannon company the morning after he knifed to death one of his own men during the banzai attack on Macon. He was no more than 30 yards or more or so away from me, but that distance may as well have been a mile in terms of our individual experiences that night. And I will never forget the first day on Guam, hearing the bullets whispering by as I lay safely in a crater at the battalion CP and watched Japanese banzaiing over a ridge some 500 yards or so away, some waving swords, some stabbing with bayonets, others tossing grenades, and Marines engaging them in hand-to-hand fighting, killing them as they were themselves were being killed on the side of that ridge, so close yet so far away from those of us in the CP. There is nothing novel in the observation that only a very small minority of the men in uniform during World War II ever saw combat, and even a smaller minority ever saw it at its essence at the cutting edge of the front lines. But veterans and civilians alike often forget that the experience of wars are relative. A few yards behind the front line is not the same as in the front lines, and the difference increases exponentially, echelon after echelon, from battalion CP to regimental CP to division to corps headquarters, finally to on shipboard to Hawaii, and finally to the mainland of United States and the White House. At this point, I'll move on to the now part of the book a little bit, and I hope I'm not running too far over time. The now section of the book begins with my experience in reading the letters some 60 years later, some 40 years later, actually, after I wrote them. As I read the letters, I found large gaps in my memory, which I fill in an attempt to fill the gaps in my memory and to understand my war. I began to read widely, compulsively, at first histories of campaigns in which I participated, then books about other campaigns and about the larger picture of war in the Pacific, then books about the origin of the war in Europe and events leading to the United States, leading the United States into the war, books about ending the war in the Pacific, books questioning the unprovoked surprise attack off Pearl Harbor, and books questioning why the atomic bombs were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Finally, more general histories, memoirs, novels, not only of World War I, but of the Civil War, World War I, the Vietnam, but especially memoirs of World War II, such as Robert Lakey's Helmet for My Pillow, William Manchester's Goodbye Darkness, E.B. Sledge's The Old Breed, Samuel Hines' Flights of Passage, Cy Kahn's Between Tedium and Terror, and many others. I wanted to see how other men had reacted to their wartime experiences on islands in the Pacific, how those experiences affected them, affected their memories, their thoughts, their attitudes, perhaps their lives. I wanted to compare their beliefs not only about the good war, but about the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the need for atomic bombs at the end of the war to mine. What I found was, after reading many memoirs, was my views about the war are often quite different from those of veterans of other veterans. And it is evidence, too, from what appears in the media and many books, that most Americans are too often influenced by what many of those veterans have said in years since about World War II. This raises one question which I had about in this book, that I don't believe in writing a memoir that it's really necessary to include footnotes. But since I was dealing with something highly controversial, really, in my attitudes about the war as they developed from my reading, from the attitudes of most veterans and most Americans, I think, I figured I ought to be able to cover myself, and so I did decide to include footnotes and references to many of the books that I read and many other books I haven't mentioned here. Also, what became clear in reading all of this was that, I want to read what I was thinking about. I'm just kind of lost at this point, I guess. In all of the reading that I did, I came up with a conclusion that, it's not my conclusion actually, but the problem of memory. And people 40 years later remember things quite differently in many different ways. And for example, James Michener was quoted in a Newsweek article in which he said that in all of my years in the Army, some 3 years in the Army, I never heard a single man complain about what he was doing at all. And then five pages after that, I came across Gore Vidal, who says, in all the years I had in the war, I never came across a single good word about that war. So this poses a very real problem for historians, because they, after all, have to depend to a large extent upon letters and diaries and memoirs, as well, of course, archived material. Because you can't read a set of letters and take them literally. You can't read a memoir and take what you read literally. And the same thing's true of diaries as well. So, but of course, by comparing back and forth, they eventually can arrive at some notion of what actually happened. Another thing that became clear in the course of my reading these books was that there are two memories of World War II, which I've alluded to already in a way, a traditional memory and what is sometimes called a revisionist memory, which I prefer to call a consensus memory. Writing about war now, I covered three main topics in the now section of the book. One, the good war, and the traditional view is, of course, that the war was a good war, the last war we could all be proud of. Actually, the war, I can't see how it could be a good war at all when 400,000 Americans were killed and literally millions of Europeans and Japanese and people throughout the Pacific were killed, and other reasons as well. Also, the traditional belief suggests that the bombing of Pearl Harbor was a surprise, and it was not a surprise to the administration in Washington at all. It was a surprise, of course, to most American people, and it was a surprise to the soldiers and Navy people who underwent it. But the people in Washington had already broken the Japanese diplomatic code, and they had a pretty good notion of what was going on. And so they knew that something was going to happen. And Roosevelt assumed that it probably would have been a bombing of the Philippines. And then some people thought it could very well be a bombing of Pearl Harbor. As early as January of 1940, 45, Secretary Knox wrote a letter to the Secretary of Defense, Stimson, and suggested that there very well could be a bombing of Pearl Harbor with the Japanese approaching on ships from the Northwest, which in fact they actually did. And then some historians have gone to the extreme of suggesting that Roosevelt knew that the bombing was going to take place on Pearl Harbor. But in my view of what I've read, at any rate, that's a little bit far-fetched. He, after all, had been Assistant Secretary of Navy, and I'm sure he's not going to look forward to having his Navy sunk in Pearl Harbor at the time. But at any rate, many books since 1950s have questioned the need for the use of atomic bombs. The traditional view is that in the summer of 1945, Truman had only one choice: invade Japan with the loss of anywhere of hundreds of thousands of lives, up to a million lives, or use the atomic bombs. But as I started to say, many historians since 1950 have questioned the need for the bombs. And I'll read a short selection having to do with that. What eventually did give me reason to farther up and say that for a long time I also believed that the bombs were necessary and that they saved lives, including my own, because as far as those of us who were in San Diego at the time at the amphibious base training naval gunfire teams, we assumed that we would probably have to go to Japan one way or another. But what eventually did give me reason to question Truman's decision was reading what many historians, professional scholars who have spent many years studying primary sources and have to say about Truman's decision. Scholars such as Robert Buto, who's, as I understand it, was a member of the department at the University of Washington for a long time, probably retired now. Herbert Feiss, Martin Sherwin, John Dower, McGeorge Bundy, J. Samuel Walker, Robert Lifton and Greg Mitchell, Barton Bernstein, John Skates, Gar Alperovitz, among many others. The consensus today among these historians is that the bombs were not necessary to end the war. An invasion of Kyushu would likely not have taken place, much less an invasion of Honshu. Japan would have surrendered even if the Russians had not declared war on Japan about the time the second bomb fell on Nagasaki, and other possible ways of ending the war known to President Truman and his advisors were not pursued. Furthermore, if the invasion had taken place, which it probably would not, there would not have been the tremendous casualties that Stimson and Truman and others had suggested. That is, hundreds of thousands up to a million. Excuse me. If you stop and think about it, there were 400,000 dead, up to a million casualties in all theaters in 4 years of the war. So it seems highly unlikely that a million casualties would have taken place in the landing of Japan. The consensus historians have often been contemptuously referred to as revisionists, and have been accused of rewriting history. The term revisionist is, when applied to historians, is usually misleading because it implies that the historian is wrong to rewrite history. But this is a mistake. It's the function of historians to rewrite history as new evidence becomes available, and also, I guess, as new generations with new generation awareness become available. And we see the same thing happening today about rewriting history. President Bush, and I'm quoting here, says, "It is deeply irresponsible to rewrite history or how the war began." In other words, he's talking about the Iraq War and what is beginning to be said about that. There's one other element which I would add to the notion of the traditional view of war, and that's called the greatest generation's view. or the view of the people who fought the war as being the greatest generation. Not only do veterans continue to justify and glorify World War II and their participation in it, but younger Americans who followed them also both glorify that war and venerate the generation that fought the war as the greatest generation. Tom Brokaw's Panglossian description of my generation in his book, The Greatest Generation, though well-intentioned, ignores such evidence, much evidence that many American soldiers and Marines on many occasions could be just as savage as the Japanese soldiers. Americans commonly killed enemy prisoners of war in cold blood or shot wounded Japanese or Japanese soldiers attempting to surrender. Americans strafed Japanese lifeboats full of men from bombed or sinking ships, as the first George Bush, included as one of Brokaw's greatest, appears to have done, according to a battle action report reproduced in Harper's Magazine. Americans killed Japanese parachuting from burning planes that had been shot down. Our ghoulishness was hardly anything to be proud of. Many American young men vied with the maggots to collect small bags of gold teeth from the jaws of dead Japanese, or even from those of Japanese still alive and thrashing about, as described so vividly in E.B. Sledge in his memoir, The Old Breed, where a Marine was trying to get the gold teeth out of the jaw of a wounded Japanese, as I say. And he was digging with his knife, and it slipped, and he ended up slitting the cheeks on each side of the Japanese, and then put his foot on the lower jaw and started digging to get the gold tooth out. Finally, another Marine came up and shot the guy to put him out of his misery. The collection of ghoulish souvenirs, including ears and other appendages, was far from uncommon. Even Japanese heads were sometimes boiled to remove the flesh so that skulls could be displayed or sent home as souvenirs, as illustrated in the famous, or at least was then, picture in Life magazine of an attractive young woman contemplating the polished skull of a Japanese head. As I think about the past actions of some members of my generation, the nation is reeling from the pictures of atrocities perpetrated by smiling Americans, soldiers in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, and we are becoming more aware of the not so well publicized vicious actions against civilians by some of our troops in Iraq. President Bush's remark that What happened in Abu Ghraib is not the American way, is naive and extreme. It's not the way of any civilized nation, country for that matter. But what does he expect when men, and now women, are trained to in the military to hate and to kill? Strip off the thin veneer of civilization from any group of men and women and free them from the restraints of society, and there will always be many American soldiers and Marines, not to mention civilians, who commit atrocities of all kinds during war and in every war in American history. It's no wonder that many veterans hesitate to talk about their war, to describe some of their wartime experiences to their wives or children or grandchildren or to anyone else. Like all people and nations, we Americans still think it is necessary to mythologize our past, to ignore many of the evils in our past, in order to legitimize our present and our greatness. Most of my generation and the generations that have followed mine seem to have forgotten that my greatest generation created the most monstrous evil imaginable, the means to annihilate every individual on earth, our species, and the earth itself as we know it. All humankind will now live eternally under that threat, as has been suggested by Bush. To finish, I would like to read one section from the chapter which is concerned about the war in my life. Now, as winter relentlessly approaches and the snow deepens and high up in the mountains, I continue to set out alone for a few hours each morning, shouldering my pack and my rifle, taking my ski pole cane in hand to search for one last elk somewhere in the subalpine firs, higher up on a ridge behind my sheep herder's wagon. That's my Alaskan camper, which looks like a sheep herder's wagon in many respects. Pushing several shells into the magazine of my .30-06 and finally one into the breech and closing the bolt, I'm reminded of my war. I remember awakening one long time before dawn, one morning, camped at my camper at the trailhead of Teepee Creek, to the sounds of all around me of squeaking leather, of movement here and there, stamping feet, mutterings, mumblings, curses, strapping on gear, rifles clicking closed as hunters moved off in the dark up the trail in twos and threes to look for elk. As I listened, I could hear again the preparations of soldiers for going over the sides of the troop ship and down the landing nets, or the muffled sounds of Marines as we moved off into the dark to take up a positions farther forward. Another day, high up on the ridge of the above Skulmarm Gulch, a fusillade of bullets fired at deer from below whispered past my head as I dived for an enfilade, and I remember many of times on Macon, on Guam, on Iwo Jima, and my orange hunting cap gave me the same sense of security as my metal helmet in battle. One afternoon, while hunting spring black bear, I stood under a large fir tree to avoid the rain, hearing in the distance the roll of thunder approaching, and then the crashing and crackling of lightning and the thunder all around me. I was reminded of the crash and crack of artillery shells exploding around me on islands in the Pacific. And as the thunder moved farther away, I thought, someone else is getting it now, and thank the good Lord that it was over, at least for the time. I felt a wartime thrill of danger one day when, armed only with bow and arrow, I slowly came to realize that I was following the trail of a bear through chest-high grass, a grizzly bear, actually, into a dense grove of trees. I see the same shape of death in the animals I kill as I saw in the human animals lying motionless, torn by bullets and shell fragments on Macon, Guam, and Iwo Jima. On occasion, I have shot an elk or a Rocky Mountain sheep, only to knock it down, wounded. When I come upon the animal and force myself to shoot it behind the ear to put it out of its misery, I am reminded of the time I saw or observed a Marine point his M1 rifle at a wounded Japanese soldier and pull the trigger. I remembered once when I was struggling with my hunting knife to cut out the ivories from the jaw of a bull elk, a vivid memory of the young, fresh-faced ensign whom I mentioned before, a shore fire control officer, with a small bag of gold teeth he had managed to dig out of the jaws of dead Japanese he came upon in the fighting, when the fighting was over in Iwo Jima. And I am reminded of wartime fear by the fear I feel now when I set out to climb a ridge at the age of 78, wondering if I will have the strength to find my way back alive as I move farther and farther away from my camp. A broken hip, a heart attack. As I become older, I find myself becoming more timorous when I followed steep, narrow, snowy logging roads or trails into unfamiliar country or climbed strange ridges, especially at high altitudes and the wind blowing, isolated and alone. I have to push myself to keep going up, but having pushed myself up to the top of a new ridge and sinking down in the snow, for a moment, I feel comfortable, elated, and I recall forcing myself to move forward, leading my men, my radio team, across the dried, cracked rice paddy on Guam, when I could hear, literally, and feel the bullets whistling, whispering by, And then the comfort I felt as I fell safely into the shell crater near my CP. So the war goes on and on and on. That one does, and it does for other soldiers. World War One, Vietnam War, and it will for the Iraq veterans as well. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry for my voice. I just couldn't make it work tonight.